Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There is a basic assumption in all the conversations about the future of Iraq, and the assumption is that Iraq has a future. Since the fall of the Ba'ath regime, American administrators in Baghdad have worked mightily to bring the Shiite of the south and the Kurds in the north together with the Sunni at the center of Iraq. That was most evident with the recent push for the signing of the interim constitution. There are people, though, who don't think that the borders staked out decades ago by European diplomats will hold. And certainly many in the north and the south see a brighter future without the control of a central government or a strong-armed ruler for all of Iraq. This hour, we're looking at the prospects of independence for the Kurds in northern Iraq. We'd like to have you join us. We'll keep it simple. Why not let Iraq break up into its more comfortable constituent parts? What's the argument for holding the country together? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to start today with our own Michael Goldfarb. He's a correspondent for the Inside Out documentary unit. He's in Erbil. It's home of the Kurdish parliament, capital of the Kurdish autonomous region in northern Iraq. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Dick.
I understand that you spent your morning actually attending a conference of Arabic-Kurdish relations where people were talking about keeping the Kurds as a part of Iraq. Explain what was going on.
Well, this is actually quite a major conference. The security here today was extraordinary, vast sections of the city blocked off. It's like when the president goes to open the General Assembly in New York at the UN. Basically, it was the morning session seemed to be as much about the Kurdish leadership, both Masoud Barzani, who leads the KDP, and Jalal Talabani, who leads the PUK, the two main parties up here, gave long speeches to the delegates. Many had traveled from as far as Karbala to say to them, we are part of one nation, Iraq, Kurds and Arabs, but we must get to know each other well. And Talabani went off on a long disquisition on federalism, trying to educate his Arab brothers from the south that the word federalism wasn't necessarily a bad thing and that regional autonomy is possibly the best way to govern rather than putting everything together in a strong center in Baghdad, as has been the case under the Ba'ath Party.
Tell me what it felt like to be there, Michael. Was there a stiffness and a formality to getting these two sides together? Is there a genuine sense from the Kurds in the north and the Arabs in the south that there is a reason to work together towards a unified Iraq?
Well, actually, Dick, it was kind of like a revival meeting. Several times when both of these leaders were speaking, men dressed, sheikhs from Karbala, one man addressed himself, just kept standing up and saying, we are with you, brothers, we are with you. And there was elation and clapping and chanting. And the spirit, actually, I think, was an attempt to be very much reaching out on another. It was a very interesting set of interactions to observe. About 400 delegates, by the way, came to this city, and as you know, given the kind of violence that's gone on in the last 24 hours, that gives you a sense of how important this meeting is.
Are they being shepherded together by the American administrators, or is this something that's happening more spontaneously, Michael?
Well, I spoke with Mahmoud Othman, who's a Kurdish member of the Iraqi Governing Council, and certainly well-respected by all parties in Iraq. He's independent. And he was telling me that this was a meeting they had been trying to organize for some time, and that, in fact, conditions hadn't really been right for it. They were even thinking of trying to have this meeting in Cairo some months ago. And now the time seemed right. And, in fact, I was speaking to Mr. Othman. I said, I'm glad that you're aware that the time is now, because you've only got 14 weeks till the CPA goes away, and Iraqis are supposed to take over the governance of their country on July 1st.
Michael, I want to use your eye to help us better understand where you are right now, because you were in northern Iraq in the mid-1990s when those two Kurdish groups you described earlier were, in essence, at war with each other and still living in some fear of life under Saddam Hussein or interference from Iranians to the east. And what do you see today? How has Erbil, how has northern Iraq changed?
Well, Dick, it is quite extraordinary. When I first came here in 1996, as you said, there was a serious bout of civil war going on between the KDP and the PUK. And in fact, when I came to Erbil the first time, there was no electricity, there was nothing, and the Iraqi army was here because they had been invited up by Masoud Barzani to help rout the PUK and drive them, I guess, to heel. Bring them to heel would be the way to describe it. When I came back a year ago to cover the war, I had expected the city to be pretty much as I had left it. In fact, it had become much more prosperous because the KDP and the PUK have signed a series of agreements. They work closely together, and the U.S. government has been able to provide some aid. And so the condition of the people was very good. Now, a year later, and this is in Erbil I'm speaking of because I've also traveled to, you know, over to Mosul, which is outside the Kurdish Autonomous Region. It's a different story over there. But here, the level of prosperity to me is actually extraordinary compared to the first impression I had those 7 years ago when I first came here. The city seems to have more people. There's a huge amount of construction of housing going on, a lot of cars, too many cars, but people generally seem rather content. The aspiration of having Kurdistan, I think, is always there, particularly for Iraqi Kurds, who have many decades reason not to trust their fellow citizens in Iraq down in the south. But at the moment, I get the sense that it's very much an aspiration. And the other thing that's on people's mind is the situation over in Syria with the Kurds, with the Syrian Kurds. As you know, there's been some ethnic clashes over there in the last week.
We'll actually get a chance to pick up both those points as we continue our conversation with Peter Galbraith, who's standing by. But, Michael, I want to thank you for being with us at the start of the program today.
Dick, my pleasure.
Michael Goldfarb, correspondent for the Inside Out documentary unit, speaking to us live from Erbil. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join our conversation about what's happening in northern Iraq, about the political aspirations of the Kurds, and whether or not those aspirations will lead to a breakup rather than a cinching together of the country of Iraq. Peter Galbraith is joining us now. He's former U.S. ambassador in Croatia, was there from 1993 to 1998. Some of the most difficult years of the wars following the breakup of the former Yugoslavia. Peter's also a senior fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C., but he's joining us from a studio in London. He's moving around a lot. Peter, good to have you with us.
Dick, good to be with you.
You've also seen that contrast that Michael was describing. Your time in northern Iraq takes you back to right at the beginning of the 1990s when the Kurds were really being attacked by Saddam Hussein. And I know you were just there a week or so ago. Do you look down the streets of Erbil and just sort of shake your head at how much that area has been transformed?
It's really stunning. I first went to Erbil in 1984. And in the 1980s, the Saddam Hussein regime systematically destroyed all the villages in Kurdistan. You had an influx of people into the city. You had virtually 100% unemployment. And then in the early 90s, you had the Iraqi regime attacking Kurdistan. You had sanctions. You had the internal war. Just what Michael was describing, no electricity. And I came back after a hiatus of about 7 years in July 2002, and I couldn't believe it. It has become very prosperous. Certainly the Kurds were helped by the Oil for Food program, where they got about half per capita of what an average person got in the rest of Iraq, but they made good use of it. And by a sense that they were running their own affairs, that they were in control. And since the war, the prosperity has simply continued. It is physically quite a different place from the rest of Iraq.
And setting aside how the leaders specifically see their place in the American-controlled Iraq right now, the average person living in this autonomous region of Kurdistan, do they see themselves, you know, like citizens of the state of New York within the United States? Do they feel like they have even more autonomy than a state within the United States? How do they place themselves?
Well, those are really two separate questions. The first question is, how do they look at themselves? Do they think of themselves as we do, as citizens of our state and of their country? And then what kind of power does Kurdistan actually have as a federal entity within Iraq? The answer to the first question is none of them think of themselves as Iraqi, or very few. If you ask them, what are you, they will say that they're a Kurd first. And on the whole, they may admit that they're Iraqis, but they don't want to be Iraqi. And even if you talk to some of the leaders who are speaking at that conference in Erbil today, for example, Barham Saleh, who is the prime minister of the part of Kurdistan that's controlled by Jalal Talabani, when he talks about Iraq, he says, yes, I want to be a Kurd. I want to be an Iraqi as long as I'm condemned to live within this country. So there's certainly no enthusiasm about being Iraqi. Every one of them, including the top leaders, would prefer to be independent if they could, but the leaders feel it's unrealistic. Among the people, there really is no desire to remain part of Iraq, and that, I think, poses a very serious problem for the long-term future of the country. Now, as to the second issue, as to how much power Kurdistan has, that is very much up in the air. The Kurds put forward a proposal as part of the deliberations on the transitional administrative law, also known as the interim constitution, that would have given them a mixture of powers between what, say, Quebec has within Canada and some aspects of what the two entities have in Bosnia. The interim constitution gave them some of those powers, but left other critical issues to be resolved in the future, particularly the role of the Kurdish self-defense force known as the Peshmerga, and whether over the long term Kurdistan will control the natural resources, and in particular the oil and water of the region.
And back in 1991, Peter, when the Kurds were being bombed from the air by Saddam Hussein, you were there, you were running for cover. At that time, I was in the refugee camps in southern Turkey watching the Kurds scramble over the mountains to safety. And I think back to that time, I look at the situation today, and I think, so why not just leave now? Isn't this the Kurds' moment? They could just say, forget it, we're Kurdistan, we want nothing to do with Iraq. And what would be the sanction?
It's unclear. That is a risky course of action, because for the same reasons that have always existed, which is the neighbors. Kurdish aspirations are opposed by all the countries that have Kurds. That is to say, Syria, Turkey, right. Iran, and Iraq. But to some degree, this is their moment. As one of the Kurdish leaders said to me last year, he said, we Kurds, we've always had four dogs that we had to worry about. But that dog in Baghdad's now dead, thanks to you Americans. The ones in Syria and Iran are cowering in the corners. And the Turkish dog has really annoyed you by the way it's behaved on the war. So this is, to some degree, our moment. The leaders have decided on a cautious strategy. They wish to first get a federal entity in which they have very large amounts of self-government, and then they intend to watch and see how it goes.
Peter, I'm going to stop you right there for half a second because we have to take a short break. We'll pick it up there as soon as we come back. Just a reminder to our listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Peter Galbraith is my guest, and we're talking about the future of Kurdistan on today's program. 1-800-423-TALK to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. In imagining the future of Iraq, is there room for imagining a separate state of Kurdistan? Would that mean a separate state in the south? Would that mean the Shiites joining Iran? Is this the sort of thing that the Americans are determined to see doesn't happen? And what are the implications of political autonomy for the different groups in Iraq? 1-800-423-8255. Peter Galbraith is with me. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, former U.S. ambassador in Croatia from 93 to 1998, and has spent much of the last 18 months actually in northern Iraq watching the Kurdish state take shape. Peter, just before we went to the break, you were making the point that many people are saying, hey, maybe this is the moment to reach for Kurdistan, but the leaders are playing it more cautiously. What's going on in their mind? What's their strategy?
Well, they very much have the history of what's happened to the Kurds, where the powers where they live have cooperated against them. And they are looking for American support, American guarantees, and they're very reluctant to take any action that is going to antagonize the United States. So they are seeking to create a federal state with a great deal of self-government. And then their idea is that they can watch how things develop. If Iraq succeeds as a democracy, and I think most of them don't think it will, but if it does succeed, then they can be part of it, perhaps cooperate increasingly with other parts of the country and with Baghdad. On the other hand, if they see a Shiite theocracy, which I think they think is the most likely outcome, or if there's another dictatorship, they want to be in a position where they can leave Iraq. And for that reason, one of their core demands that was unresolved by this interim constitution is the role of the Kurdish armed forces. These number about 100,000. The Kurds would like to convert them into some kind of Iraqi Kurdistan National Guard, a bit like a U.S. National Guard, where they appoint the officers and the commander. It would be nominally under the control of Baghdad, but it would be a kind of insurance. If things go bad in Baghdad, it would come back under their own control.
Now, the Kurds got some concessions in the constitution. I mean, concessions, I guess, is a quarrelsome word here. But Arabic and Kurdistan are the two official languages of Iraq. Am I right about that?
Arabic and Kurdish are the two languages. And on this point, they borrowed very consciously from Canada, where they saw that the equality of French and English had helped the French, who had traditionally been discriminated against, at least in the 19th century, achieve equal status and, in fact, to have a disproportionate role in Canadian politics.
And the one aspect of the Canadian thing that is still not resolved is that question of a veto over changes to the Constitution, over the definition of the status of Quebec within Canada. Did the Iraqi Constitution give any comfort to the Kurds in terms of defining a veto or defining what the power of the state would be in the months and years ahead?
Well, there are two points. First, there are certain limited powers that go to the center that relate to foreign affairs and defense. But outside of those limited powers, Kurdistan has the right to amend any national law. So in effect, it has a veto on national laws. The second issue is, how is the permanent constitution of Iraq going to be adopted? The approach of Paul Bremer, the American administrator, was that it should be done simply by a referendum, a majority of the Iraqis. Well, the Kurds realized that if that was the case, nobody would pay any attention to them in the process because the Shiites are likely to have an absolute majority in the Constitutional Convention. So they insisted that they should have a veto. That is, if two-thirds of the people of the three Kurdish governorates reject the Constitution, it doesn't come into effect. Interestingly, that argument went back and forth between the Kurds and Bremer until the Kurds sent him a copy of Article 7 of the United States Constitution, which said that the U.S. Constitution didn't come into effect until it was ratified by 9 of the 13 states, and then it only came into effect among those 9. And I think when Bremer pondered the implications of that, he said, no, this is reasonable.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Sal's on the line. Sal, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I had originally one comment, but I would like to make two comments, if that's okay.
I'll ask you to be brief. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. I heard your guest calling the neighbors of Iraq our dogs, but I want to say something about the North neighbor, which, I mean, that dog saved 500,000 Kurds during 1991 because we opened the border and they let the Iraqis, the Kurdish, come in. And when Syria and Iran, nobody opened the door for them. And we give them the no-fly zone with the permission of the Turkish military. And we protect them for 9 years.
Yeah, you're talking about Turks in the north. And
yeah.
I just want to let Peter in here because I think that Peter's use of the word dog was not actually meant as a reference to the country, Peter.
Well, first, it wasn't my characterization. I was just quoting somebody who was describing how these different countries had worked together to keep the Kurds down and how the war had put all four of them in a disadvantage. But what Sal has been saying is completely correct. The Kurdish people would not have survived in Iraq had it not been for President Özal in 1991 and the decision of the Turkish government to allow the refugees in and then to facilitate the creation of the safe haven. And indeed, over the last 12 years, Turkey has developed very good relations with the de facto independent Kurdish region in northern Iraq. Now, this story isn't told in many parts of the world, but it has to be understood that Turkish policy is much more nuanced than it is commonly perceived. I will say, though, in 1991, the Iranians also allowed the Kurdish refugees into Iran.
I want to go back to you, Sal, and if you don't mind, have you answer the question of the show today, and that is, you know, what you think of the idea of an independent Kurdistan in northern Iraq?
I'm just wondering why they cannot be unified, because they basically want Mosul and Kirkuk, which is the oil-rich area, and they will give them a lot of power in the north, and if the Shiites get the south, that's going to be another oil area, and the people in the middle is suffering. What I'm saying is, it's just one country. Why try to make it three or four or five? Can you imagine, we have a lot of Mexicans here. Can you imagine all of a sudden the Mexicans try to get back Texas or California, or they want their independence for some reason? They're living in the nice variety of the United States, and they are not claiming anything. I'm wondering why the Kurdish cannot do the same thing. It's just one country. Simple as that.
Peter, talk to Sal.
You don't need to make a Kurdistan or...
Okay, Sal, let's hear from Peter on this if we can.
Well, Sal, of course, there are many differences between the experience of the Kurds in Iraq and the experience of the United States, where all these different groups have come to the United States. The Kurds did not want to be part of Iraq when it was created. It's an artificial state. But more than that, the entire history of the Kurds in Iraq has been one of repression and brutality. It goes back to the founding of Iraq. It was, of course, the worst during the time of Saddam Hussein, and it actually escalated to genocide in the 1980s when Saddam systematically destroyed all the villages, used poison gas, executed well over 100,000 people. So for the Kurds of Iraq, the country has been their enemy. The Iraqi army has been the only enemy they've ever known. And so, of course, it's a problem for them when the Americans come in and say, we're going to rebuild a new Iraqi army to defend the country. That's not how they see it. And it's going to take a long time to overcome that history. It might be doable if the Kurds have a sense of security by having a great deal of autonomy, including their own self-defense forces. But I think we have to accept the possibility that this might not succeed. There's no inherent reason to hold Iraq together.
In large part, it might not succeed on that basis, because if the Kurds got to keep their own self-defense forces, that would mean that the Shiite in the south would have the same rights and the Sunni would have the same right. You would, in fact, have three separate militias within what we now understand as Iraq. I mean, that's part of the problem, isn't it?
And indeed, one of the reasons the Americans have been troubled by the issue of the Kurdish Peshmerga, who were the allies, American allies in the war, in fact, took more casualties than the British, is because of the precedent that it sets for the Badr Brigade, one of the principal Shiite militia. But there's a larger issue here, and it's something I can speak of from what I saw in the former Yugoslavia, which is that it is virtually impossible for a country to be a democratic country to be unified, where people in a geographically defined area almost unanimously don't want to be part of the country. And that's the case in Iraq today. The country can be held together by the way it has been for 90 years, by a dictator, of which Saddam Hussein was simply the latest in a long line. But it's very hard for a country to be democratic and unified under those circumstances. And in the end, I don't think that that kind of dictatorship is sustainable. And so at some point, whether it's 2005 or 2015, Iraq is either going to have to find a formula, I think, again, a very loose federation where its different peoples can live together, or accept that it doesn't work and create two or three states. And there's nothing really wrong with that.
Let me stop you there, Peter. And I want to go back to your experience in Yugoslavia, because I think that's very instructive here. But I want to bring Ahmed Al-Rahim into the conversation. He's a professor of Arabic language and literature at Harvard University. He's been listening to our conversation. Ahmed, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I understand that you were born in Beirut to an Iraqi family, lived much of your life in the United States, but you've been back to Iraq a number of times since last April. Is that right?
That's right, including Kurdistan.
And so when you hear Peter talking about the Kurds really not wanting to be a part of that country, and that there really may be nothing wrong with letting the different groups in the country go their separate ways, what's in your mind? What are you thinking?
Well, what I'm thinking is that the Kurds have had their own independent area since 1991, and have had a parliament and a government, and are finding it very difficult to reconnect with the rest of Iraq, which was under Saddam Hussein. So part of it is just the developments and progress of Kurdistan compared to the rest of the country. And I think also the recent interim constitution, where Sistani said that the Kurds will not be allowed to, or should not be allowed to, veto the permanent constitution. This position that Sistani has taken has made the Kurds respond in this way by calling for separatism as a kind of threat, that if we're not allowed to determine the final form of the constitution as a minority, then we are willing to secede. So I don't think practically it's going to work out that way, that Kurdistan will secede.
But would you make the case that Kurds should remain as part of Iraq?
Absolutely. And I would say that the majority of Kurds, at least the political leadership, sees themselves as Iraqis. And in the first instance, they wouldn't have gone along with this war if they didn't see themselves as Iraqis. They could have continued the autonomy that they had there without necessarily going along with the war. And it was a gamble that they took, but a gamble that was based on a sense of Iraqi nationalism that they have.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Peter Galbraith, a different story here from Ahmed, who says that many Kurds, most Kurds, see themselves as Iraqis.
Well, there's some very simple evidence on this point. In the week before the interim constitution was adopted, leaders of the referendum campaign came to Baghdad with 1.7 million signatures gathered in the Kurdistan region calling for a referendum on Kurdistan being independent. Now, 1.7 million represents probably two-thirds to three-quarters of the adults in Kurdistan. And those signatures were collected in just 1 month. And, of course, nobody signed the petition except those who wanted independence. As to the idea that the Kurdish leaders supported the war out of a sense of Iraqi nationalism, I don't think that's the case. In fact, I think many would have been quite happy to have continued the de facto independence they had. But they knew they were dependent on the United States. They knew that President Bush was determined. And so they made the very practical judgment, and I think from their point of view completely correct, that they would support the United States and reap the benefits, as indeed they are.
So Ahmed, how, if you were at, for example, at that conference that Michael Goldfarb's covering in Erbil, how would you make the case to a Kurdish person that, you know, you're better off in rather than out?
Well, if you look at the history of Iraqi nationalism, it really is based on how the minorities defined it, including the political minorities, including the Shiites, Iraqi Jews, and the Kurds. And so what we have to think about is, what is this new Iraq going to look like? And it's not going to be one that's premised on pan-Arabism, which the Sunni political minority has put forward under Saddam and before then. But it will be one that is inclusive of all the ethnic groups, and also that if one looks at Mosul and Kirkuk, these are not cities. They do include Turks, but they also include other minorities, the Turkoman, Arab, and so on. How would they be included in this Kurdistan?
What's lost?
Would lead to some sort of civil war.
Ahmed, then what really, in a nutshell, is lost if the country of Iraq, as we understand it today, breaks up?
Well, what is lost is the experience that Iraqis have shared during these years, including that of the Kurds in Baghdad. The Kurds, if you look at Baghdad, Baghdad is broken up into many of these ethnicities, and they all live and share different neighborhoods. So the view in Kurdistan is not necessarily representative of the entire Kurdish view, which would include the view of Kurds in Baghdad and other parts of Iraq.
Ahmed, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Ahmed Al-Rahim is a professor of Arabic language and literature at Harvard University. He does have his finger on something that a lot of Iraqis hold dear, and that is that despite the strong arm of Saddam Hussein, it is a country where minorities received a certain degree of tolerance over the years. Is that all lost if Kurds in the north decide they want to go their own way, if the Shiite in the south make the same decision? What is the point in keeping Iraq together? Is it a lesson in democracy and tolerance for the rest of the Middle East, as certainly some within the Bush administration would have us see it? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Peter Galbraith is my guest. He spent much of the last couple of years in northern Iraq watching Kurds who live there make their moves towards independence. They are still within Iraq, still a part of the interim constitution, but many people there thinking that they'd be better off on their own. We'd like to have you join our conversation about that this hour. 1-800-423-8255 to get in. Let's go to Lexington, Massachusetts. Peter's next. Peter, thanks for calling.
Yeah, Peter Galbraith has spoken about the justice of the Kurdish cause, and certainly, judging by what I've heard from American soldiers, including my son, they talk about the Kurds and the Iraqis as if the Kurds are not Iraqis, and they are completely at ease with the Kurds, whom they trust, and not so with the other Iraqis. But geopolitically, would not an independent Kurdistan do a great deal to help split non-Arab Muslims from Arab Muslims, and might be an example to the Berbers of North Africa? And is this not really the larger interest of the United States, not in promoting keeping together three ex-Ottoman vilayets, but rather in splitting Islam as much as possible by emphasizing national identity? This was done in Afghanistan with the cult of Massoud. Would not an independent Kurdistan do more to defend against the worldwide jihad than keeping this state together?
Peter Galbraith, how much does the American attitude towards, or the way that it wants to be seen in dealing with Islam, have to do with their own sense of what's right here?
Well, American policy is almost the opposite of what Peter describes. The United States has always been in favor of preserving existing states. The first President Bush, for example, opposing the breakup of the Soviet Union, up until the moment that it actually took place. And the same was true of the desire to hold Yugoslavia together. Mm-hmm. I don't think that the Kurds are that there's going to be an issue affecting the unity of worldwide Islam if Kurdistan becomes independent. There are, after all, a majority of the Muslims are not Arabs, and you have radical states as well as moderate states, both in the Arab world and in the Islamic world that is non-Arab. But there is a religious issue here, which is that the Kurds and particularly the leadership are very strongly secular. And one of their great concerns is that the Shiites would want to impose Islamic law, change the status of women who have made a lot of progress in Kurdistan, abolish the sale and use of alcohol, which is widely enjoyed in Kurdistan. And this kind of divide it could well become much worse after elections in which the Shiite religious parties win a majority in Iraq.
It's right to say, isn't it, Peter, that the Kurds are a mix of Christians, Muslims, other religions?
They're overwhelmingly Muslim, but there are Christian communities in Kurdistan. They aren't really Kurds. They're Assyrians and Chaldeans. And
but see themselves more as Kurds than they do as Iraqis, I suppose.
Well, they identify with the Kurdish leadership, with the Kurdish people, because they live among them. But they're quite distinct, and they have their own language. Kurdish is an Indo-European language, whereas Chaldo-Assyrian is, in fact, a Semitic language, along with Hebrew and Arabic. There's also a group of people known as the Yazidis, who are Kurds, but who are much a pre-Islamic religion that involves some elements of Zoroastrianism and also a worship of Lucifer.
Let's go to Amherst, Massachusetts now. John's on the line joining us from there. John, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Peter, do you agree with Leslie Gelb's column in the New York Times recommending that Iraq be divided into three parts? No matter what word you use, isn't it the same situation as in Bosnia, where I believe you, along with Leslie, dragged your feet in terms of recognizing that the solution there as well was to divide, to partition the place into three parts, even though you continue to call it two entities? Is it not, in fact, three separate entities, and is that not the solution for Iraq as well?
Well, it's interesting. Les Gelb's piece recommended a kind of Yugoslavia solution for Iraq, that is, the Yugoslavia that Tito created, in which you have three different republics, which are virtually independent, but you know, with a few functions at the center, like a common foreign ministry. And I think that's a very sensible way to go. I won't attribute any responsibility to Les Gelb for the Clinton administration Bosnia policy in the 1990s, because he was outside of government at that time. But there is a huge difference between Iraq and Bosnia. In Bosnia, the extreme violence, genocide, in fact, was used to redraw ethnic boundaries and to expel people from mixed areas. In Iraq, by and large, the different communities are already living in different areas. And there is, in fact, very little ethnic tension in Iraq. Well, there's separatism, but not a lot of ethnic
you've
tension.
You've got a lot of Arabs living in Mosul and Kirkuk, people who were moved north by Saddam Hussein to sort of keep his hold on that oil-producing area, though. Isn't that true?
And there were a lot of Serbs in Croatia, which you, Peter, recommended be independent without recognizing the minority Serbs and Croatians' desire for national self-determination. If Yugoslavia was such a happy place where each group had its own autonomy, why were there such wars of national self-determination?
Well, just for the record, I didn't become ambassador to Croatia till 1993, that is, after it had become independent. And the U.S. did propose a model for Croatia that would have granted the Serbs a great deal of autonomy within Croatia. And it was the Serbian side that refused to engage in negotiations about it. In the case of Iraq, First, the Kurds have never said that Mosul should be part of Kurdistan, although it is an ethnically mixed city, about half Arab, half Kurdish. They do claim Kirkuk, as do the Arabs and the Turkmens. It's very hard for any outsider to sort out who is right. Each group has statistics to show that it really is the majority. We do know that in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, Saddam Hussein tried to re-engineer the ethnic composition of Kirkuk, forcibly expelling Kurds, bringing Arabs from the south to settle there. There is broad agreement that those people who were expelled should be able to return home and recover their property, that the settlers should be given incentives to leave. And certainly, whatever happens to Kirkuk, there are going to have to be special arrangements that would entrench power sharing among the different communities, and which would have to have some democratic process, like a referendum, which would allow its people to decide whether it wanted to be part of the Kurdistan region, whether it wanted to be a part of the rest of Iraq, or whether it wanted some kind of special status.
Peter, I want you to bring us back in if you can, to what we understand about the breakup of Yugoslavia. I mean, a big story in the news today is an upsurge in violence in Kosovo, where the Albanians and the Serbs are arguing over cities and towns and places that they've been arguing over for the last 12 years. And I know there are success stories in the breakup of Yugoslavia, but we tend to focus an awful lot on what didn't work. And I wonder if Yugoslavia really stands as a really good example of what might happen in Iraq. Do you know what I mean?
Well, the problem in Iraq has been the extraordinary violence that has been used by successive Iraqi regimes to hold the country together. The story of Iraq is, in fact, even worse than that of Yugoslavia. You had the Saddam Hussein again destroying every village in Kurdistan, massacring over 100,000 people. You had 300,000 Shiites killed in about 6 months in 1991, the destruction of the Marsh Arab culture. All of this in the name of trying to forge a single Iraqi identity and to hold the country together. So there can be things that are even worse than the breakup of a country, and that is holding it together. But there's some other lessons from Yugoslavia which didn't need to turn out the way it did. The Slovenes, who were the people whose independence movement basically unraveled Yugoslavia, were prepared to accept a loose federation or a confederation. It was Milosevic who refused to accept that and therefore led the Slovenes and then the Croatians to move to independence. It is possible to hold Iraq together by accepting the aspirations of its different communities for self-government.
Peter, I just need to stop you there for half a second. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We have time for one more call. And we're going to go to Malden, Massachusetts, and Seamus is with us. Seamus, thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you. Well, thank you. I'd like to say hello to Peter and hello to Dick Gordon. First of all, I would like to say, thank you for NPR covering the Kurdistan itself. Well, hello. There is 35 million people living in the Middle East, and they don't have any right to determine their future.
Have you got a question for Peter?
Okay, my question is to Peter. I don't know if Peter is an international lawyer or not, but my question is to him. Does every nation has right to determine their future, where they live, especially if there are 35 million living in the same region? And why is there not any question to the nation itself to determine their future?
All right, Seamus, let me, if I can, take that and put it in a way that's perhaps a little more clear. When Seamus talks about 35 million Kurds, he's talking about Kurds in Iran and in Syria and in Turkey, as well as in northern Iraq, and whether or not the people in all those other states don't also have a right to some kind of self-determination. And Peter, if I can just turn the question a little bit, I mean, isn't this in many ways one of the problems that lies ahead for the idea of an independent Kurdistan, that you'd have more of the type of fighting that we'd see in Syria? We'd have the Turks getting increasingly worried about that, and as a member of NATO, sort of putting the boots to the United States over that. Isn't there that risk of independence in northern Iraq?
Well, the first I would say to Seamus that in general there is a kind of sympathy in international law to the idea that people might have the right of self-determination, but it's not an unlimited right, and it has to take into account the concerns of others. And one of the issues here is, in fact, the concerns of Turkey, Iran, and Syria, just as you said, Dick, that if there's an independent Kurdistan in Iraq, it might encourage independence movements in their own countries. And Turkey, for example, has just ended a 15-year war with a Kurdish separatist military movement.
Right. So
but that
jumpy.
Said, the reality is that the situation in all those countries is quite different. Turkey is heading toward Europe, possibly joining the European Union in the next few decades. And I think most Kurds in Turkey recognize that they would do much better off continuing with Turkey, but in circumstances where their rights were respected. What people are demanding in Syria is not independence, but simply recognition of Kurdish language and of a Kurdish identity. The Kurds are related to the Iranians ethnically, and so there are autonomy demands in Iran, but no real independence movement. The nub of the separatism issue really focuses on Iraq, and it probably does not. It probably is not going to extend beyond Iraq in the sense of Iraq, an Iraqi Kurdistan becoming the nucleus of a movement for greater Kurdistan.
You said earlier in the program, Peter, could be 2005, could be 2015. What's your thinking?
Well, I don't think it will be 2005. I think the current generation of Kurdish leaders are committed to give a try for Iraq. The trouble is the next generation, for whom Iraq is either a bad memory or who have really grown up independent from Iraq and have no desire to come back under the control of Baghdad. And particularly if Kurdish demands are resisted in Baghdad, if Sistani, for example, is insisting that Islamic law should apply throughout the country, then there's going to be a reaction in Kurdistan.
Peter, I got to stop you there. I'm afraid we're out of time. Peter Galbraith, former ambassador to Croatia, currently senior fellow at the Center for Arms Control in Washington, D.C. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. We'll be right back.